if you were expecting me to give an exposition of this book, then you're not going to get that. And what's more, from the fact that this book appeared and we want to sell copies, you will get an idea of what the answer to the question about is reformism finished. If reformism was finished, why the fuck would we write a book about the Labor Party? I mean, it has sunk without a trace anyway, but never mind. Class struggle is a necessary feature of capitalism, and it's the feature of capitalism that we place the greatest stress on because it holds the promise for a different kind of world. Now, that class struggle can take the form of insurrection. It can take the form of indefinite general strikes. It can take the form of strikes. It can take the form of occupations or sit-ins or stop work meetings. And it can be at a very, very low level, like your supervisor walks past, and as the supervisor walks that way, you go... That, I mean, that is a very low-level form of class struggle. But what they've all got in common is that they're about trying to improve your situation. Doing this is largely a psychic improvement in your situation. It doesn't necessarily materially improve your living standard. But what class struggle is all about is improving workers' quality of life. And class struggles generally take place in a context where the people who are doing them are not thinking about changing the mode of production, overthrowing capitalism. Class struggles are about concrete kinds of issues. Now, in certain circumstances, those concrete issues can have a revolutionary significance. The 1905 revolution, that mass strikes in the 1905 revolution were triggered by printers who were out on strike over whether they were going to be paid for the spaces that they put into the hot metal type. You know, this is not a fundamentally profound question of revolutionary principle we're talking about here, but nevertheless, it had a revolutionary significance in those circumstances, whatever was in the heads of the printers at the time. And I don't think that in the heads of many of the printers, there might have been some Bolsheviks amongst them, the heads of many of the printers was, well, we want to get rid of the autocracy. It was much more, we want to get paid a little bit more money so that we can have improved living standards. So most of the time, the kinds of ideas in the heads of people who are engaging in class struggle are reformist ideas. It's reformism as an ideology. That is the idea that I want to get reforms so that my living standards will be improved without particularly thinking about the broader context of capitalism. I want to get these reforms. And that doesn't inherently challenge the capitalist system. It doesn't necessarily involve thinking about a challenge against capitalism. Early organised workers' class struggles, organised class struggles, were regarded, and perhaps they were, challenges to the capitalist system. Regarded not so much by the workers who were involved as challenges to the capitalist system, but rather regarded by the representatives of the capitalist state and many capitalists as threatening capitalism. So they, by and large, in the late 18th century and the early 19th century, they faced significant repression. So the Combination Act of 1799 in Britain was designed to prevent trade union organisation at all. The persecution of the Tolpuddle martyrs in 1834 was another, essentially, an effort to repress trade unionism, and, you know, Tolpuddle martyrs ended up in Australia, agricultural workers who were found guilty of administering an oath. But basically they were found guilty of setting up a trade union. Now, the largest class struggles of the early 19th century were those in Britain around Chartism. And what the Charter called for was basically parliamentary reform. It made demands for universal male suffrage, which was a major advance. It did eliminate half of the population from having a vote, but it was a major advance on the situation previously where only a very small minority of people had the vote. It called for annual parliaments. It called for the secret ballot and paid parliamentarians. These in themselves were not revolutionary demands, but they were proletarian demands. They were working class demands. Why? Because for working people, reform of parliament was a means of improving their living standards. It was an instrumental approach. It wasn't democracy is lovely, so we want democracy. It's we want democracy so we can shape the way in which politics operates in Britain, the way in which class relations operate in Britain. There was a left wing in the Chartist movement, the so-called physical force Chartists, who believed that the only way in which they could achieve the reforms that they wanted to see was through the use of physical force. In other words, they were actually revolutionaries. And in that spirit, Marx and Engels were also revolutionaries. And what they did was bring together the idea that workers were justified in struggling in their own interests with the idea of socialism and the idea of democracy. There was an intersection for the first time in history, really, between the ideas of socialism and ideas of democracy in Marx and Engels's work, the idea of socialism from below. Previously, utopian socialists like Saint-Simon and Owen and Fourier had talked about socialism, and I suppose you'd call them conspiratorial socialists like Blanqui had talked about socialism, but they hadn't talked about the working class being an agency for its own emancipation. This was an original contribution by Marx and Engels to discussions about socialism, to perspectives about how to achieve socialism. Marx and Engels regarded the trade union struggles of the 1840s as a direct threat to capitalism. And this was the way in which many capitalists in the capitalist state also regarded them. Engels wrote that the trade unions were schools for war. As schools for war, the trade unions are unexcelled. But by the 1860s, Marx and Engels' assessment of trade unions was rather changed. And that was largely because the nature of trade unions was somewhat different by that stage. Whereas the Chartist movement and the trade unions that had been associated with the Chartist upsurge had been really mass organisations, trade unions in the 1850s and the 1860s were largely bodies of highly skilled workers fighting in circumstances where the bosses and the state were prepared to make concessions and were prepared to make concessions in order to incorporate, at least in part, the trade union movement, even though trade unionism wasn't thoroughly legalised in Britain until the 1870s. Marx wrote in 1867 that trade unions were mainly concerned with guerrilla war against the effects of the existing system. That is, they didn't challenge capitalism, instead of simultaneously trying to change it, instead of using their organised forces as a lever for final emancipation of the working class, the ultimate abolition of the wages system. And trade unions had become organisations that were perfectly compatible, well, not perfectly, were quite compatible with capitalism at this stage. We've had reformism as ideology for a very long time. With the domestication of trade unions, we have reformism as a form of working class organisation, and reformism institutionalised in the labour movement. Now, Marx and Engels, despite their recognition that the trade unions of the 1850s onwards had limitations, nevertheless, of course, still supported trade union struggles. They could see that struggles around demands for immediate reforms, even if those reforms were not the kind of challenge to capitalism that such demands had been 20 or 30 years before, were important, because out of them workers could build confidence and a perspective of demanding more and generalising their desires for a changed world. There were similar developments in Germany where the trade union movement was co-opted by capitalism, was recognised, given legal status by the German state. Rosa Luxemburg observed that the specialisation of professional activity as trade union leaders, as well as the naturally restricted horizon which is bound up with disconnected economic struggles, in a peaceful period, leads only too easily amongst trade union officials to bureaucratism and to a certain narrowness of outlook. Both, however, express themselves in the overvaluation of the organisation, which from a means has gradually been changed into an end in itself, a precious thing to which the interests of the struggles should be subordinated. From this also comes that openly admitted need for peace that shrinks from great dangers and presumed dangers to the stability of the trade unions. And further, the overvaluation of the trade union method of struggle itself, its prospects and its successes. Luxemburg here is recognising the form of reformism as organisation, and she is identifying a particular layer in society that plays a crucial role in such reformist organisations as trade unions. It's in this period, the late 19th century, that we see the emergence of a different kind of reformist organisation, not simply trade unions, but also political parties that are workers' political parties, but which operate within the framework of capitalism, except that their demands to improve the conditions of the working class should be achieved and are achievable within the framework of capitalism. One of the aspects of the emergence of these two kinds of reformist organisation is a separation of politics and economics under liberal capitalism, liberal democratic capitalism. On the one hand, you have the sphere of the economy. Class exists there, inequality exists there, and what the working class is concerned with in economic terms is carried out by trade unions and trade union struggle. On the other hand, you have politics, where, as you all are fully aware, we're all equal. After all, each and every one of us, unless we don't have that great blessing of not being an Australian, of being an Australian citizen, we all have one vote. So we're all equal. There's this illusion of political equality while there is economic inequality. And that an acceptance of that distinction between politics and economics is something that is characteristic of reformist organisations, where politics is the sphere for a reformist party, like the Australian Labor Party or the German Social Democratic Party or the French Socialist Party, and so on and so forth. Lenin identified the way in which workers' parties can be serve the interests of capital. And in particular, he observed that the British Labor Party and the Australian Labor Party were liberal, that is, capitalist workers' parties, that they accepted the framework of capitalism, that they operated on the assumption that the goals that they set themselves could be achieved under capitalism. Lenin eventually identified the German Social Democratic Party in a similar kind of a way, but Rosa Luxemburg had done so somewhat earlier, although the key leaders of the German Social Democratic Party had professed a commitment to Marxism. Despite their critique of reformism as ideology and reformism as organisation, whether it's trade union organisation or political party, Lenin and Luxemburg, for that matter, were committed to supporting workers' struggles in the framework of the economy in particular, supporting trade union struggles. Luxemburg highlighted how the rapid shift from struggles over economic to revolutionary political demands could occur, although only in the sultry air of the period of revolution, in her work on the experience of the Russian Revolution of 1905, the mass strike. She talks about how political and economic demands can interpenetrate each other. Demands for political advance can give workers courage to make demands for economic improvements and vice versa. How do we explain the emergence of reformism both as ideology and as organisation, and the pervasiveness of reformism inside the working class. Engels and Lenin recognised this phenomenon, and they attributed it to the influence of a particular layer of workers, what they called the labour aristocracy. I'm not going to go into an argument about the labour aristocracy, except to say that it's actually wrong. Rosa Luxemburg came up with a much more satisfactory explanation of the pervasiveness of reformism and how it is embodied in a particular social layer, that is, of the trade union bureaucracy. And in our political tradition, we draw on the insights of Rosa Luxemburg, but also insights of other commentators who don't belong to the Marxist tradition or only peripherally belong to the Marxist tradition. Sydney and Beatrice Webb, definitely not part of the Marxist tradition. Robert Michels, who was for a while a bit of a Marxist before he becoming a fascist somewhat later on, but he wrote a very impressive study of the German Social Democratic Party, a very insightful study, and also the work of Leon Trotsky, who of course was a full-on Marxist. And within this framework, we can identify reformism as a product of, firstly, the experience of subordination to capitalism and the fetishism of commodities, the way in which the experience of operating under capitalism, living under capitalism every day, makes it seem inevitable. The way in which capitalist exploitation actually occurs makes it appear as though we're engaged in equal relations with our employers rather than exploitative relations. After all, I'm paid for the work that I do. I get money for the work that I do. I do a mediocre day's work at work, and then I get money for the work that I've done. So that conceals the exploitative nature of capitalism. It's capitalism's self-camouflage. But beyond that, there's of course bourgeois ideology that is actively propagated by the bourgeoisie through the mass media and the statements of politicians, arguments about how what's really important is that we're all Australians, and that questions of class are really not significant at all, that, you know, mateship is vastly more important than the fact that my boss at the university gets paid, I don't know, something like $900,000. And most of the people who work at the university get paid well under $100,000. Those ideological aspects of capitalism, both those that arise from just the way in which the economy operates and the constructed ideology that we get bombarded with every day, they discourage revolutionary ideas and encourage us to think that if we want to improve our lot, then we should do so within the framework of capitalism, and in fact that it's only possible to do so within the framework of capitalism. The other factor that is crucial in understanding reformism is the role of that layer that has an interest in the maintenance of reformist organisations, trade union officials as a distinctive layer in society with interests that are not the same as those of the workers who they represent, because trade union officials, full-time trade union officials, are by definition not workers because they are employed by the trade union. Their job is not to make profits for the boss. Their job is to try and do a deal with the boss over the wholesaling of the members of the trade union's ability to work. And they play this mediating role in society. And similarly, in reformist organisations, parliamentarians, elected officials of the state who come from parties like the Australian Labor Party or Social Democratic Party are not workers. They're not employed by a boss to make profits. They are employed by the state to perform certain representative functions, and they have an interest in maintaining the existence of capitalism. So, despite the neoliberalisation, I guess we could call it if we wanted to make a very long word, despite the move to the right of the Labor Party and other such parties, the way in which the economic programs of the Australian Labor Party, the British Labor Party, the French Socialist Party, the Norwegian Labor Party, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, are essentially indistinguishable from the economic programs of the conservative parties in those countries. Can we say that reformism is finished? Can we say that reformist parties' capitulation to neoliberalism means that reformism is dead? Well, revolutionaries argue and act against the forces of reformism, but are only likely to win over a majority of the working class when the level of class struggle is very high. Reformism is something that is likely to have a very enduring existence under capitalism. That may be reformism in the form of an ideology when there is no reformist political party, even if there are reformist trade unions. So in the United States, reformism as an ideology is alive and well, despite the fact that there isn't anything as pathetic as the Australian Labor Party, with its base in the working class, a diminishing base in the working class, but nevertheless a base in the working class. But reformism helps explain the way in which significant numbers of workers were caught up in the enthusiasm for Barack Obama when he was elected in 2007. Reformism as the idea that it was possible to make advances within the framework of capitalism is something alive and well in the United States, despite the fact that there is no reformist political organisation there. And similarly, the Greens in Australia have benefited from this kind of a reformist ideology, despite the fact that the Greens are not a reformist organisation in the sense that they have a serious base in the working class, the way in which the Labor Party, for all its right-wing policies, has that base in the working class in terms of the core of its electoral support and in terms of the way in which trade unions are actually a part of the Labor Party and the significant role that trade union officials still do play in the Australian Labor Party. What's more, old reformist organisations, even if they are significantly weaker, and we know that in New South Wales, the Australian Labor Party won, 25% of the vote in the New South Wales elections. The German Social Democrats were in third place in the elections in Baden-Württemberg about a month and a half ago, behind the Christian Democrats and behind the Greens, who now have their first premier of a German state. Despite these things, that these reformist political parties are still in existence, as of course are trade unions. What's more, it's also possible that new reformist organisations can emerge. So we saw in the mid-2000s the emergence of Die Linke in Germany, the left party in Germany, as a new reformist political formation in Germany. Not a huge one, but nevertheless one that still gets between 5% and 10% of the vote in national elections in Germany. We can look at the experience in South Africa during the 1970s, which saw the emergence of a new militant black trade union movement, which eventually it formed a peak body called the Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU, in 1985, which was the most powerful element in what was then called the Revolutionary Alliance that effectively ended apartheid in the early 1990s. So the Revolutionary Alliance isn't called the Revolutionary Alliance anymore in South Africa. We call it the Triple Alliance, because revolution, as far as COSATU is concerned, as far as the South African Communist Party and as far as the African National Congress, the other two partners in the Triple Alliance are concerned, is not on the agenda. So there was the emergence of important reformist organisations in the recent period. We can look at the rise of the Movimiento Aquí Socialism in Bolivia, as also that the expansion of a reformist force in Bolivian politics, especially in the early 2000s, out of the struggles of 2000 to 2005, although the party had existed somewhat earlier. But what I want to talk about is Brazil, because they have better music. Because basically, we don't know much about Brazil, but the experience of Brazilian politics, Brazilian working class politics since the 1970s shows in a speeded up form the way in which reformism can be reproduced, the way in which reformism can rapidly move to the right as well. Although reformism in Brazil is not off the political agenda. In fact, the Partido dos Trabalhadores, Thomas Lincoln told me how to pronounce it, won the presidential elections, only a few months ago in Brazil. In the late 1970s, a new mass trade union movement emerged in Brazil. There had been official trade unions, which were effectively tame cat unions, but out of some very intensive class struggles in the late 1970s, at the core of which were metal workers in the ABC district around São Paulo, which is the industrial capital of Brazil. Metal workers' disputes were at the heart of these kinds of struggles, but they spread across the whole of the country, recruited large numbers of workers into active trade union membership and militant trade union activity. In 1977, there was a strike by 300,000 metal workers in the ABC district, which won improved wages and conditions. And that was just the forerunner of a strike wave from 1978 to 1980. A key figure in these struggles was a guy called Luiz Ignacio da Silva, who's best known as Lula, who was for 8 years the president of Brazil from 2002 to 2010. He was a trade union leader who had a background actually in a corrupt communist-led trade union machine from which he broke and oriented to rank-and-file militancy. And the level of militancy was incredibly impressive. In 1978, the ABC metal workers, especially in the car industry, went out again in May of that year, and they won a 25% wage increase and triggered a strike wave across the country. By the end of that year, there were 500,000 workers on strike. There was a further general strike by workers around São Paulo, metal workers around São Paulo. And Lula describes the first mass meeting of 80,000 people during this strike. The fences, the stadium, the grass, everywhere was full of people, and the podium was only a little table. The sound system wasn't even big enough for a small room. You know what we did? We kept them there for 4 hours on the field without a sound system. I yelled, the people in the front of me repeated what I'd said and passed it backwards. When it started to rain, a few people started to leave. I shouted that no one there would dissolve in the rain and nobody else went away. I mean, this was a committed bunch of very, very militant workers. And that sentiment, while its core was amongst the metal workers, spread across the entire country and continued in the face of some police repression as well. In 1979, 3 million workers struck. Overall, huge numbers of workers were involved who hadn't been involved in strike activity before, and they were drawn into very militant class struggles. In the face of declining economic conditions in the early 1980s, they also built really powerful shop floor organisations in workplaces, delegates structures in some workplaces, in other workplaces, what they called factory commissions, that is, locally elected organisations of militant workers to negotiate with the bosses rather than simply rely on the trade union officials. One of the products of this period of mass struggle was the foundation of the Partido dos Trabalhadores, the Workers' Party of Brazil. And it was in particular a response to the question of state repression. It was established on the initiative of trade union officials, notably Lula in June of 1980. And a number of far-left organisations went into and helped build the PT, as I'll call it. But it was a large organisation, and it had a radical programme. Its leaders spoke in terms of socialism and in terms of revolution. They talked about the party's program in 1988, talked about non-payment of the foreign debt, which was the big issue, nationalisation of the financial system, health services, education and public transport, and agrarian reform under workers' control. The dominant faction inside the PT was the Atikula Thau, which was a faction effectively led by trade union officials. The party within 3 years had 200,000 members. A few years after the formation of the PT, a trade union federation of the militant trade unions that had either broken with the corrupt structures of the old trade unionism or new trade unions that had emerged, a new federation was established, the Central Unica dos Trabajadores, the trade union, the single trade union centre, in 1983. And it soon had many more members and much more influence than the rival federation based on long established conservative and corrupt trade unions. There was a dramatic overlap between the leadership of the CUT, the Trade Union Federation, and the PT, the political party. And the key figures in this overlap were trade union officials. The party had significant electoral successes from 1986 onwards, especially, and Lula and a number of other trade union officials, as well as some other people, entered the Federal Congress as deputies for the PT. By the early 1990s, the party had 600,000 members. By the end of that decade, the CUT, the Trade Union Federation, had 20 million members. So we see here the emergence of major reformist organisations in the neoliberal period. Large organisations emerging out of significant class struggles. And in some respects, the PT benefited from the economic crisis that was the background to neoliberalism, a reaction against the conservative policies of various Brazilian governments. But this economic decline also saw some decline in the scale of rank and file organisation, which it wasn't possible to sustain once the economy began to contract. From the early 1990s, however, the CUT moved rightwards. And those of you who either lived through or have read a little bit about the Accord will recognise some of the rhetoric that the CUT leadership used in order to justify their rightward shift. They talked about the unions having to move away from the previously purely defensive struggles, merely reactive policies. And what trade unions had to do was propose concrete alternatives. Sounds terrifically militant, doesn't it? You know, we're going to build socialism here and now. What it really meant was we're going to design policies that are acceptable to the capitalist class. In practice, therefore, the CUT accepted the neoliberal agenda and pursued class collaboration through tripartite discussions with the bosses and the state. Again, something that is a bit similar to the Prices and Incomes Accord only a decade after it had occurred in Australia. The PT also moved to the right, especially after the failure of Lula's presidential bid in 1994. There was another defeat in the presidential campaign in 1998, and the PT Congress in 1999 adopted the program for the Brazilian Democratic Revolution. They were still using a revolutionary rhetoric, but it was for reforms within capitalism in alliance with other forces. This represented a significant defeat for the left, including the revolutionary, the genuinely revolutionary left, inside the Workers' Party. But in 2000, the PT won 20% of the vote in Brazil overall, and also control of a number of large cities, including Sao Paulo, the main industrial centre in Brazil, and also Porto Alegre, which was where the World Social Forums happened between 2001 and 2003, sponsored by the left PT government, municipal government of Porto Alegre. By 2002, the success of the PT was such that 10,000 of its members paid the so-called party tithe. The party tithe was levied on members of the party who were elected state officials or who were employed in the offices of elected state officials. In other words, there were 10,000 PT full-time politicians and their minders. This is a really significant layer inside the party, and it was this layer that was crucial in the move of the party to the right during the 1990s, and even more so in 2002 in the run-up to the next presidential elections in which Lula was determined to win. He issued a letter to the Brazilian people, and that letter was a letter of capitulation to neoliberalism. That's really what it should have been labelled, although you know, it probably wouldn't have helped the election campaign if it was labelled that way. The PT guaranteed that they wouldn't challenge capitalism, that they would continue with the IMF program that the previous government had agreed to. And in fact, in office, the Lula government increased the budget surplus to a higher level than that had been promised to the IMF and by the previous government to 4.25% of GDP. Lula's at first administration attacked public service pensions, successfully attacked public service pensions in the way in which the Cardoso government, which had preceded him, had not succeeded, although it had tried. Lula introduced a neoliberal tax reform to make the taxation system even more unequal, to make a shift away from income tax to consumption taxes like our GST. And it also introduced industrial relations reforms that reduced rank and file autonomy and increased the power of trade union federations. Of course, the PT made arguments at state, municipal, and then at the federal level about how they were the lesser evil. You know, we might not be doing stuff that's all that great, but there's an economic crisis that's going on, so you should vote for us rather than for the conservative political parties. A major corruption scandal broke in 2005, and Perry Anderson said that in cash terms, the corruption which the PT had benefited from and over which it presided was probably more systematic than that of any predecessor. What the PT had done was bought the votes of members of other parties in the Brazilian Congress in order to get legislation through the Congress. It also emerged that a slush fund had been in existence since 1995, operated by the dominant faction in the PT in order to dominate the party more effectively by buying support within the party itself. Lula and the PT were able to consolidate that position not only through corruption and the use of the lesser evil argument, they also introduced some welfare reforms that gave a bit to the very poorest of Brazilians, and the very poorest of Brazilians are very poor indeed. The poverty line in Brazil is only $300 a month, what was only that in 2010. And the PT also bought off the Trade Union Federation by putting it in charge of the country's largest pension fund so that trade union officials became people who made decisions about investing vast quantities of capital in the Brazilian economy. So the major beneficiaries of developments in Brazil since the PT took power have been the very rich indeed. Not only is reformism not finished in Brazil, but the presidential candidate of the PT won the last elections only a few months ago. Dilma Rousseff won the elections for the presidency of Brazil. So they're back in office in the most powerful job in the country again. So the bankruptcy of reformist organisations does not automatically lead to their collapse. Lula won the 2006 elections despite the fact that he'd engaged in unremitting attacks effectively on the working class. He won the subsequent election in 2008, largely on the basis of the Brazilian economy's expansion. Brazil has benefited from Chinese economic growth in the same way as Australia has benefited from Chinese economic growth. In the second half of the 2000s, Brazil's economy was doing quite well indeed. So while reformism may capitulate to right-wing politics, this doesn't mean that reformism is going to disappear. Neither reformism as an ideology at the most basic level can be a hope for reforms within the framework of capitalism, or reformism as an organisation. These things are, these developments, right-wing movements of reformist organisations don't mean that the way is open for us socialists. We don't say, or we, at least we shouldn't say, that it's really great if reformists sell out because, you know, as the German social democrats said, after Hitler us, as the German communists said, after Hitler us, it's not the case that there is an automatic correlation between reformists selling out and political support flowing to the left of politics at all. Reformism is a real hydra-headed monster. I've got a picture of a hydra here. Sort of a snaky thing with lots of heads. And the only way to slay that monster is not by waiting for it to move to the right and falling over and dying. Rather, we've got to be like this proletarian revolutionary here. We've got to be armed with a sword of clear revolutionary politics and to chop off all of those heads in order to lead workers' struggles in a direction that isn't reformist but is rather revolutionary.